Good morning, ladies. Good morning, ladies. I have a special privilege this morning in our lecture series of Distinguished Women in Government. It's my pleasure to introduce to you the Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska. She's an attorney for the Federal Field Committee for Development of Planning in Alaska. She has a very distinguished background and certainly academic degrees and membership in many distinguished organizations. But I think more important, she's here to speak to us this morning, and we want to move on to that. So it's my privilege to introduce to you Esther C. Wanicki.
Anyone who can say Federal State Land Use Planning Commission and pronounce Wanicki correctly passes the course. Actually, I was Assistant Attorney General for Alaska. I am now recently appointed by President Carter, the federal co-chairman of the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission in Alaska, which is an unusual body. Is that working? Oh, here we go. Is that better? Oh, it was such a small room. I'll back up a little bit. I was recently appointed by President Carter as the federal chairman or co-chairman of the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission for Alaska, which is a unique body in and of itself. The appointment requires Senate confirmation, and it's my understanding that that was one of the criteria for selecting the speakers in this series. I appreciate the fact that you're here, particularly when someone of the stature of Midge Costanza is speaking in another room. I presume that you wanted to know who I am and where I am and what I do and how it affects your lives and what it all means. I found it a little difficult to think of myself as being at the top, so to speak, in giving briefings from the top. It's something that makes you just a little bit dizzy. In working through this talk, I had to re-examine my own life, I think, to understand where I am with respect to the women's movement. And I think it's important to understand some basic things about me. First of all, something that I think is something you may share and that's very important in my own background is that I descend from a long line of pioneers. And my families have always gone farther and farther west. And Alaska is about as far west as you can get and still be in the United States. And I think that that's an important heritage, even though I didn't have role models as women lawyers, for example, and I went on to become a lawyer myself, in that pioneer women, basically, have always stood shoulder to shoulder with men and have done the same kind of work and accepted the same kind of challenges and the same adversities as their men have. Another important aspect in my own development was the fact that I'm the daughter of a very strong woman who was the first woman in her family to vote. She was the first woman in her family to bob her hair, and she was the first woman in her family to get a divorce. And at the time I was growing up, I was very much a minority in my school as the daughter of a divorced single parent, whereas my children growing up today are very much, I guess, in the minority because their parents are still married to one another. She was a very strong person. I was never conscious of the fact that she was ever discriminated against because she was a woman, because in her own spirit, I think she felt no diminishment by being a woman. At least it was never conveyed to me. I only remember one time when the law in New Mexico required that a woman must register to vote by her married name. And although my mother was divorced, the election official still insisted that she register as Mrs. James H. Crane. And she was very proud of her right to vote. and also very incensed at having to use a name that didn't belong to her. And so she gave up her right to vote in order to protest that use of name that was not hers. One of the things that she did for me, and I hope that this is instructive to me and to anyone else dealing with young people, is that she never tried to make decisions for me. And when I was a teenager, I used to think that this was really terrible of her to not help me when I had hard decisions to make, not say, well, if I were you, I'd do this, or this is the best choice, or you should take that job, or you should, you know, wear that dress, or whatever the case might be. Instead, she always said, use your own judgment. And at the time, I railed against it, thought she was not uncaring, and thought she was a terrible person. I've blessed her every day of my life since then that she made me use my own judgment. I got a late start in life as far as family is concerned. I have teenagers of my own now, and I realize at what cost she did that she allowed me to make my own judgment and to step back and not interfere in my life. I'm afraid I'm not nearly as successful as she was. I'm too inclined to say, go here, go there, do this, do that. As I say, I had no role models as far as being a lawyer is concerned, and yet I was never told I couldn't do anything. I've always said that I'm just like the bumblebee. Nobody ever told me I couldn't fly. So when I graduated from high school, it was at the time of the Depression. I couldn't afford to go to college. I had to stay home and help my brothers run their business, particularly after one of my brothers was drafted in the Army. This was at the time of World War II. And I felt a great deal of resentment about that. Later, when I did have an opportunity to go to college, I went as far away from New Mexico as I could get, and I went to the East Coast, and I tried to enroll in Georgetown University Law School. And in those days, they didn't take women. They blithely told you that you were not being admitted because you were a woman. And I guess it's to my discredit that I didn't burn any buildings down or didn't start a protest of any kind, but just meekly said, oh, okay, and went to George Washington University, which did take women. I've experienced, I expect, the normal kinds of discrimination that all of you have. I mean, the subtle kinds of put-downs that you really can't say anything against, the paternalistic kind of discrimination, which I think is the most debilitating kind of discrimination. I think that if someone hates you and resists you overtly, you're strengthened by that battle. But if someone pats you on the head and says, there, you know, let me do this for you, then you're less of a person. And I think that's the most weakening kind of discrimination. So enough about me, so you kind of know where I'm coming from anyway. It's obvious from looking at me, of course, that I belong to the generation before Madison Avenue. I think this is another aspect of... Well, you know, at the end of World War II, Madison Avenue convinced all women to go home and see how clean they could get their corners. And so somehow I escaped that part of it. But I think that's another aspect of it, is that I was never... and why perhaps I don't have some bitterness that other friends of mine do have, is that I was never taught any of the female games, or I was never taught any of the myths. So I didn't have anything really to unlearn. As I say, with the kind of mother I had as an example, I had discriminations, of course, but I didn't have to unlearn a lot of things that were not true. It's very unusual, I think, for people to be in resource work or in land use planning. It's more normal, I think, to find women in high places, so to speak, in education or health or welfare. Another aspect, I think, of my attitude is is that Alaska, because it's largely an unstructured society, I think it's easier for women to accomplish something in than perhaps more structured societies. This is not to say that there's not a large attitude in Alaska. I think that it's very chauvinistic, and Alaska is often viewed as a man's country and a young man's country. But it is an unstructured society compared to some others. And I think that statistics will bear me out that in the legal profession, there are twice as many women lawyers in Alaska proportionately than there are women lawyers in other parts of the country. There are twice as many women doctors in Alaska proportionately than there are in other parts of the country. A large part of that, I think, is that Alaska attracts young and vigorous people. Let me tell you a little bit about the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission and some of the issues with which we deal. We don't deal directly with programs affecting women, but we do deal with the environment in which you and your children and your grandchildren will live. The commission is a unique body that was established in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And as a lawyer involved in public land law, Alaska probably is the most challenging place in the world to be right now, because it's not only a physical frontier, but an intellectual frontier. There's more public land law being made in Alaska now than has been made in any part of the United States in the last 50 years. The commission is half federal and half state. There's a federal co-chairman, which I now am, although I've worked for the commission as co-counsel for a number of years, so I'm not unfamiliar with its past work, and a state co-chairman who is, in fact, the governor of the state, but he designates a full-time person, in this case a man by the name of Walt Parker, with whom I've worked for a number of years. It has four members appointed by the Secretary of the Interior, and it has four members appointed by the governor. And its charge in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is to advise the president and the Congress and to advise the governor and the state legislature with respect to policy and land use problems affecting federal and state lands. To understand what the challenge in Alaska is, you have to understand some of the basic things that are happening there. When Alaska became a state in 1959, it was granted the right to select 103.5 million acres of land from the then federal public domain. This was accomplished without any recognition of the fact that the native people of Alaska, the Eskimos, Indians, Aleuts of Alaska, had never relinquished their aboriginal title to the land. And in 1971, a congressional settlement was reached called the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which to extinguish this aboriginal title that the peoples of Alaska held, granted to them, or rather returned to them, the right to own 44 million acres of Alaska land and a payment over a term of years of about $1 billion. Native does not have any pejorative meaning in Alaska. It's a shorthand way of saying all of the aboriginal peoples, the Alaska Eskimos and Aleuts and various tribes of Indians who make up that population. So in that short span of time, you have a great deal of land being selected by the state of Alaska. You have a great deal of land being selected by native corporations. And then you have the determination, which is now before the Congress and a matter in which we are spending a great deal of our time, how the remaining federal land in Alaska is going to be managed. And that's the person probably who will benefit from those decisions. That issue, Alaskans call the D2 issue, a shorthand way again of identifying a provision in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which was in Section 17 D2 of that act, which authorized the Congress to set aside additional national parks, national forests, national wildlife refuges in Alaska. This, coupled with the management of fish and game resources in Alaska and the necessity of providing for the subsistence needs of the native peoples in Alaska and trying to accommodate different cultures in the state through the provision of a preference for those subsistence needs is probably, and I have a lot of Alaskan friends here, as you can see today, they'll agree, one of the most emotional issues in and out of Alaska today. So those are the kinds of issues that we deal with.